Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the WOW Academy Review. WOW is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The WOW is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Do You Speak Credit? When we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai. You and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits, benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. But George Bush said that what Americans want is jobs, jobs, jobs. But that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. And that's because there's no money, not in public business. It's certainly not in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's why I contend that it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits that come from the Old Covenant contract. That Old Covenant contract pays in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called property, instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults, and while you're at it, order my free General Law CD package at the same time. It's no obligation. It's free of charge. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and free of charge. You can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about these clauses in standard contracts. You know, when you go in to buy an automobile, you sign a contract. You go in and you buy a consumer good, a boat, chainsaws, or you open an account and you've got Bank of America card or Visa or whatever, the oil company or gas company credit cards. All these cards use what we call conditional sales contracts. It's a contract, and a contract is an agreement. An agreement, a covenant, contract, agreement. It's a property right. The guy that owns that contract owns a piece of property, and property is the holy grail of law. In law, private property trumps all other cards played on the courtroom floor. Property. That's what you're after. Now, Americans think of themselves as being property owners. You know, you're driving a car, and you say, well, that car is my property. And you pay a property tax. And you pay your property tax on your home, and you say, well, I'm a property owner who pays property tax. I own property. Now, the truth of the matter is you don't own the home and you don't own the automobile, and the evidence of that is the property tax that you're paying. It's the prima facie evidence that you don't own the property. Think about it. The very definition of the word property, go to Bouvier's Law Dictionary now, boys and girls, and look up this word property, and you'll see it's the right that you exercise over the external things of the world to the total exclusion of everybody else. In fact, there's a clause in there that says not only everybody else, but everybody else in the universe. And the word universe is used in the definition of property in Bouvier's Law Dictionary. If God Almighty claims it, it's not your property. Now I hear religious people say, well, those children over there belong to God, or my house belongs to God, or this or that belongs to God. Now, that's not what the Scripture says. And that's what religious people say, but that's not what God says. That's not what the Bible says. There are certain types of property that God has given us. You know, he gave David Saul's wives. He killed Saul and then gave David his wives. Those wives were his property. Children, under the common law, were the property of the father, not the mother. Women don't own children, never have, never will, and don't know. But there are certain things in life that you can own to the exclusion of me and anybody else that's on planet Earth or by God Almighty himself and all the angels and everybody else. But it's not your home. That's owned by GMAC or by the county, or it's owned by some credit union or the bank or a finance company or a mortgage company. Your automobile is owned by your local bank or maybe GMAC or Ford Motor Finance or some other outfit. And even if you paid for it, you're still paying a rent on it. You have to register your car every year. Do you notice that? Well, that registration fee is for the license plates, and the license plates are the flag because it's a flagship. And it's registered, and you're a sea captain licensed to operate this vessel on rivers of tar, around islands, that backs up to docks. Those are maritime, those are admiralty terms. And they're the exact opposite to private property. Now, back in the 1930s, we got off on a tangent here. We decided that we wanted to abandon the republic and embrace the democracy, and we adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. And the very first act that President Roosevelt did was he closed the banks and enacted House Joint Resolution 192, which called in all the gold. It changed the payment from gold to commercial paper. Very, very important legal move on the part of the president, because it divorced all Americans from their property. And it embraced the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. Abolition of all right to property. So we have property now in America that's owned by the state. This was started back about 1868 with the 14th Amendment, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. These are called the Reconstruction Amendments. Listen to this. People used to own people. Those were called slaves. In the Bible, they're called bondservants. But we called that slavery. And so General Grant, I think it was Grant, General Lee certainly owned slaves. And I think at one time General Grant owned slaves, as I recall. You know, that famous Yankee Civil War general. And many, many Yankees up north owned slaves at the time of the Civil War. So slavery was a very well-established, common property practice here in the United States. 13th Amendment, people look at that and they say, well, see, we abolished slavery in the United States. Well, that's a fiction. Slavery hasn't been abolished in the United States. We still practice slavery, bond servitude. But we don't have private slaves. They're all publicly owned. Now, instead of calling you slaves or bondservants, we call you employees. And we still buy and sell people in this country. People don't see it quite the way that they saw slavery in the 1860s, and that's because of the propaganda that goes along with it. But think about it this way. Aren't baseball, football, and basketball players bought, sold, and traded? I remember reading a paper, an article one day, and this ball player was being interviewed, and he said, I didn't know anything about the trade until I read it in the paper that I'd been sold to the Seattle Mariners. He was a Yankee, and he was sold to the Seattle Mariners. Well, actually, what was being sold here was his contract. Because, you see, slaves or bondservants come into being because of a contract. It's an agreement that is made. And we do that today. In fact, young people today would almost figuratively cut off their left hand to get a contract with the New York Yankees. I say figuratively. I mean, the guy doesn't want to really cut off his left hand. But he would willingly sell himself. And what he's really doing is selling his time. We do this in a contract. I come out to remodel your kitchen, and I say that for $10,000, you can buy 3 weeks of my time, and I will do this for you. I'm actually indebting myself to you when I sign that contract. And that's what a contract does. It creates a debt. It creates a property. We can do it with our bodies. It's called a personal recognizance bond. We can do it with our houses, chattel properties. We can do it with money. Now, these contracts become property of the fellow who owns the contract. And in this case, what we're talking about here are conditional sales contracts. These contracts belong to the companies that make them up. And this is why the credit card business is so lucrative. This is why they're out here sending you credit cards and doing everything they can to entice you into signing this contract. That contract's very valuable. Very valuable. Because it can be sold to somebody else. And what we're really selling is you. The other day I told you about the last program, I told you about a student had called up and the contract on his house had been sold to another company. See, you can discount those contracts. I mean, I could have a $50,000 mortgage on your house and you're paying me payments, you know, of $500 a month. And you're paying these mortgage payments to me for 20, 30 years and you've been paying for a number of years. And one day I need some cash and I take that over to a mortgage broker and I say, hey, I got a $50,000 mortgage here. It's a seasoned mortgage. This guy's been paying on it for more than a year. And I want to sell it to you. And the guy says, okay, well, I'll give you, that's a pretty good contract, I'll give you $40,000 for it. That's a 20% discount. It's a discounted mortgage is what's going on here. It's a part of the commercial property. It's a part of the Uniform Commercial Code. It's a part and parcel with property and property rights. Goes on every day. Now, the guy who signs that contract impairs his liberty for a number or a term of years. He affects his status. And this is why we call this status and contract. Americans used to be... It used to be in this country that Americans were very solicitous of and very, very jealous of their status in society. I am a free white male. That was a status. You could be an indentured black slave. That was a status. You could be an unmarried female, or you could be a married woman. So those were statuses. Now there's 23 of these various statuses that we have. Now if you were in India, they'd call you a caste. You belong to this caste. They call it the caste system over there. Okay, here in the United States, you know, we don't like that. That's a naughty word. It's politically incorrect. And so over here, we call it your station in life. And Ted Kennedy has a station in life. He's a senator. And President Bush, his station in life is he's the president of the United States. And then you come on down the line over here, pretty soon you got a guy, and his station in life is that he's a pitcher with the New York Yankees under contract to George Steinbrenner. And Steinbrenner says, I will pay you $7 million. I remember reading a contract here not too long ago. A guy was offered $7 million to play baseball with the New York Yankees. Boy, I'll bet that guy was happy. Now, Steinbrenner can take that contract and sell it to the Seattle Mariners. He can discount it or he can sell it for profit. I mean, he could sell it to the Seattle Mariners for $14 million. And you have the same obligation under the terms of that contract to go to Seattle, Washington, and play ball for the Seattle Mariners. In fact, that contract is going to have clauses written into it that you agree to, you ballplayers out there, whether you ever read those contracts or know what they say or not. So don't get uppity now with George Steinbrenner and say, well, I'm not going to play ball for the Seattle Mariners. Oh, yeah, you are. And if you don't, you're going to pay some pretty heavy penalties. And you better play good ball for the Seattle Mariners, too, or you're going to pay some heavy penalties. Because that's all written up in the contract. Those contracts are not written for ballplayers. Those contracts are written for the corporation known as the New York Yankees ball team or ball club. That contract is ordered up by George Steinbrenner, the owner, the manager, the chief executive officer. It isn't there for the benefit of the ballplayers. It's there for the benefit of the corporation. And that's what you're dealing with here with conditional sales contracts. We're not writing these contracts up for consumers. We're not writing these contracts up for the buyers of these Ford Explorers. We're writing these contracts up for the benefit of the Ford Motor Company or for the Bank of America or for Citicorp or for somebody else. And when you sign that contract, you have indentured yourself. You have impaired your liberty to some degree for a period of time. And that's worth money, and that can be bought, sold, and traded. So when you sign this contract, the reason that we use the term credit debt serf or a credit debt slave is because that's what a contract is. So when you go over here and you sign an employment agreement with an employer, you become an employee. You become a credit debt serf. You're an asset to the corporation, an asset to your employer. And these employment contracts aren't written for employees. They're written for the employers. They're written for the Halliburtons and for the Donald Trumps of the world. They're not written for the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives that are out here working and busting their butts and doing the physical work. All right, so that's what contracts are all about, and that's what contracting is all about. Now, I'm a general contractor, and I hire carpenters. And when I hire this carpenter on as an employee, I can't own that carpenter. And he can't indenture himself to me. He's already owned. He has a Social Security number, and he's already owned by the United States of America. And you can read that in Deuteronomy 28, verse 68. And at some point in the future, you Americans, and you Canadians, and Australians, and New Zealanders, and so on, are going to be bought, sold, and traded by these nation corporations to other nation corporations as chattel property. That's coming. You haven't seen it yet, but it's on its way. Because the world is going back to its feudal roots. Well, you know, that's what God says. I don't know, maybe he's lying to us or maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about, but at least that's what he alleges and that's what he's telling us. So I thought this week it would be important for us to understand some of these terms and conditions. So in the last program, I pointed out to you two of these conditional sales contract clauses. One was the wage assignment clause, and the second one was the waiver of your right to privacy. Now, the Constitution of the United States guarantees you the right to property. But if you want to waive your right to property, that is your wages, that is your salary, that is your money, you can do that. And a legal question arises here. Do your rights supersede contract, or do your contracts supersede your rights? Now, we Americans use terms like we're free, white, and 21. And we use the word free and freedom here in this country quite often in our casual conversation. There aren't very many free men in the United States of America. There are a lot of people that talk about freedom and who claim to be free. I see a lot of young men running around with earrings in their ears. I was watching 60 Minutes the other day, and they have a correspondent there by the name of Ed Bradley, a black man who wears an earring. I often wonder, as I watch these young men with these rings in their ears, if they understand what that symbol, that ring in your ear, means. It's the symbol of a bondservant. It's the symbol of a slave. It is a symbol of something that I don't think that you would want to run around telling people, hey, look at me, see this ring in my ear? This ring in my ear, that means that I'm a slave. I've often said to my students, take a look at these Gordon ears. There are no holes in these ears. George Gordon is not a bondservant. Now, there was a time when we identified our bondservants by boring a hole through their ear, and then to keep the hole in the ear open so that it doesn't seal up or heel over, we would put a ring called an ear ring in the hole to hold it open as the sign of your subjection to me as a bond servant. And you were bonded to your master. This is, of course, part and parcel with feudalism. Well, a contract does the same thing. It's a written instrument. Well, the contract isn't written. All contracts are oral, but we reduce it to writing. Or when we freed a slave, we would give him a written release, and he had to carry that release with him everywhere he went. Now, your government requires that today. They require that you carry identification with you everywhere you go. A free man does not carry identification. A bondservant, a slave, carries identification, either the identification of his master or the identification or the instrument that shows that he's been freed. So when the police officer stops you alongside the highway, he comes up to the window of your car, and the first thing he asks is for your identification. He says, "Your license, please. I want to see your license. I want to see what plantation you belong to." He doesn't ask you, "Sir, are you a free man?" When he walks up to the window, he knows that you're not a free man. He knows that you're a bondservant. He knows that you're a slave. He knows that you're in feudal serfdom, because he is. He's a feudal serf. He's owned by the state of Missouri. He's an employee. He is a bondservant of the state of Missouri. He carries his identification papers with him at all times. Now, there was a time in America when Americans could walk around on the streets with no identification. Today, employees carry little cards that they clip to their apparel to identify them. They're identified as an employee of Halliburton or Boeing Aircraft or a school teacher that belongs to this certain school. And now children are being identified the same way. In other words, we have now come from freedom, full circle, until now we're identifying ourselves as bondservants and slaves in our society. So children are taught from the time they're in the first grade that they've got to carry their identification on a little card that they clip on, and then they have to go through metal detectors, and they got to go through various ceremonies in order to get into and out of buildings and into and out of their jobs. This is their employments. And school teachers are bond servants who work for a school. We call them employees today, but that's what an employee is. They have a contract, and that contract binds them to the terms and conditions that are spelled out in the contract. And they can't act for themselves. They have to belong to a union, and the union acts for them in a guardian-ward relationship. So the teacher is a ward of the union, who is acting as their master to go in and deal with their employer, who is their master, and the two masters go in and determine what the employee will and will not do, how the employee will and will not act in his employment. And we call that freedom here in the United States. That's called bond servitude, you know, in the scripture. And in law, it's bond servitude. So the 13th Amendment freed you from private ownership and placed you in public ownership. And that's why you carry a Social Security card and a driver's license and registration. And that's why when somebody in authority demands your identification, you have to produce it. I don't have any identification, none. And that's because I know who I am and I know what my status in life is. Now, there's no law in the United States that requires you to have identification. But I'll bet you that every one of you listening to me right now has identification. You've got something in your pocket with your picture and your name and an identification. Now, I want to demonstrate. I don't have a Social Security card. I don't have a Social Security account. I don't have a driver's license. I don't have a business license. I don't have a passport. And I travel around in the United States of America, and I do business here. And it's becoming a real pain in the neck, because now, you know, you're just out here on the street, and there's going to be some officer come up and say, "Hey, you. Identify yourself. I know you're a slave." And then I got to explain to this guy, "No, my status, my station in life is something different. I'm not an employee." You know, the people will ask me, I say, well, where do you work?" "I don't work. I'm not an employee." "Oh, well, then you must be self-employed." "No, I'm not self-employed either." "What? You're not employed and you're not self-employed." Their brains go into double blank. It doesn't compute. Can't figure that out. Because in America, all we can think of is terms of employment or self-employed. You've got to be employed. Why? And I told you already, there's no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. Now, there's money in property, but there's no money in employment. I mean, you know, you make a living. I mean, if that's what you want to do is make a living, you know, get out there and get after it. I mean, but if you want to make money, if you want to have station, you want to have property, you want to have something, then you're going to have to do business. And you can only do business in this country in two forms. It's either private business or public business. And everybody does business in public business because it's the only thing we know. Now, there used to be knowledge of private business in the United States of America. It's kind of lost today. It's lost in the same way that our Republican form of government is lost. People, they don't know what that is. They think of America as a democracy, and it is. It has been converted from a republic into a democracy. But your Constitution guarantees you a Republican form of government, not a Democratic form of government. Now, I presume that Americans know what the difference is between republics and democracies, and that they made a voluntary, knowing, informed, and willing choice when they chose this democracy over their republic. I presume that Americans know and understand what contracts and what contract clauses are and what they mean when they sign a contract. I happen to know as an instructor in law that most people don't, but we presume that they do. In the same way that the policeman presumes that you have a driver's license when he comes up to the window. He presumes that you have identification. When you walk into a bank, you know, they require identification to cash a check. Makes all the sense in the world. Now, people who deal in checks deal in public business. Now, I don't deal in public business, so I don't deal in checks. I don't have the problem with the bank because I don't do business with banks. I don't borrow money. I'm a lender, not a borrower. Most people are borrowers, not lenders. I know it's a wild new concept. But the God of the Bible promised you that you would lend, but not borrow. Did you know that? You're not supposed to borrow. You're supposed to lend. You're not supposed to be the servant, you're supposed to be the master. You know, when Moses came down off the mountain, he came down with 10 commandments on 2 tables of stone, and he came down with a parchment that had the laws written on it, and in the laws, those laws on parchment or papyrus were put into the Ark of the Covenant. There's 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. They're organized into 133 subject matters or titles of law, of which bond servitude is one of those titles of law. There's a social status called bond servitude. But there's also a status called master, and you were supposed to be the master, not the bondservant. Now, in America today, we have all become bondservants. We're publicly owned by the government, as evidenced by our social security numbers, working for employers who are corporations created by the government. As old William Bendix used to say, God, what a revolting development this has turned out to be. Well, I'm not telling you anything that you probably don't already know. But we got to take our break right here, and when we come back, I'm going to show you a waiver of a right to privacy clause. That's what we stopped on last time. And I'm going to show you what happens when you sign a conditional sales contract and you waive your rights in favor of privilege, because you don't want to be a master, you want to be a servant, and the debtor is servant to the lender. Now, you've probably heard that. The debtor is servant to the lender. So why would you want to borrow? Why don't you want to become a lender instead of a borrower, a master instead of a servant? Well, it's a wild new concept for Americans, but stand by and we'll cover that when we come back. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And for more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools we teach here. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact discs, so you don't have to come here to school personally. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and our archive. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, history, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. And remember this, too, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just go to the telephone, pick it up, and call 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967, and ask for your free general law CD package. Okay, now finally, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our webpage, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about, do you speak credit? Now, Americans deal a lot in credit, but they don't speak credit. They don't really understand what credit is, how it works, why it works that way, and what the legal ramifications are. And when we talk about the right to collect deficiency clause, there's a clause in a consumer contract, and it says that the owner of the contract has a right to collect a deficiency. Well, what is this deficiency all about? It says the creditor may retain the goods as his property or may sell or otherwise dispose of the item pursuant to the State Uniform Commercial Code, whereupon the debtor shall be liable for and shall pay any deficiency on demand. Whew. Now, that's kind of an obscure statement to the average layperson, but what that means is If I have to repossess what you bought from me, and if I don't get a good resale price for that item, then you will still owe me the difference. To give you an example, if I repossess a perfectly good $500 television set from you because you didn't pay me, and then I turn around and sell it and I only get $150 for it, you lose the TV and you still owe me $350. That's what the deficiency clause is all about. Well, isn't that just real special? Not only do I repossess the property in question, but you have to pay me the difference between what I got for it. Now, you don't have any input over what it's going to sell for. So let me show you. Here's a real neat program. You go out and you buy a $30,000 car. You sign the contract and you got this deficiency clause in it. So you make your payments on this thing for a year and you get into trouble for whatever reason and you let the car go back. All right, so I take the car back and now I turn around and I sell this car for $5,000. You have paid me $5,000 over the year, probably. You had $500 a month, that'd be $6,000 in a year. You paid me $6,000, and I turn around and I sell it for $5,000. Now, that's $11,000 out of the $30,000. So there's a $19,000 deficiency, and I come against you, and I go into court, and I get a judgment against you for $19,000. Can you see why so many people are forced into bankruptcy? Now can you see what the creditors have done? Now that they've got all the people of America involved in credit, buried up to your eyeballs in credit, these same lenders, these same bankers now went to the Congress that they bought and paid for years ago and had them change the bankruptcy law so that you can't bankrupt out of that deficiency. We're going to stick that deficiency up your backside for the rest of your life. That's what we're going to do to you. Now, up until now, you've been able to bankrupt out of that deficiency. When it got to be too great, you just said, well, we'll just chuck it. But now you see, the bankruptcies are now so numerous in the country that the lenders said, okay, well, it's affecting our profitability. There were more bankruptcies in 2005 or 2004 than there were in the entirety of the 1960s. The whole decade of the 60s didn't produce as many bankruptcies as last year did. So they simply went to the Congress and said, hey, change the law. Here's what we want. And Congress gives the banking industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the auto industry, whatever they want. They see, they go to their lobbyists, the lobbyists go to the legislators want to get reelected, and so the lobbyists give them their reelection money. I mean, you plumbers, carpenters, and electricians out there aren't sending any money in to buy elections and to influence the votes of those parliamentarians, but you can best well bet that Sears is. You can best well bet that Donald Trump and all of the big financiers and all the big banks and Halliburtons and all the rest of them are. So that's what that deficiency clause is all about. It means we're going to take the toy away from you, then we're going to sell it to one of our buddies for $5,000. So I forgot to tell you, we don't have to sell that, you know, out here in the open market in an auction on the courthouse steps. I mean, we can sell that to our buddies. This is very common among the IRS, crowd. They'll get some guy that's in trouble, not paying his taxes or something, and then they'll seize his house, and then they sell it to a fellow member of the IRS for $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. I mean, they get $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 houses for $5,000, $10,000. And then you still have to pay the tax. So you'd have been better off if you'd put your house on the market and sold it for $300,000 and then paid the IRS $150,000, which was your equity in it. Because when they take it, they take your equity and then they sell it to a buddy. Well, that's what the car dealers do. That's what the banks do. If you want to know why, when you get foreclosed on and they sell this stuff and it brings nothing, it's because they handled the sale. I mean, they can't sell it for nothing. I mean, they can't sell it for $1,398. But, you know, they can take a $100,000 house and get $20,000 for it. Yeah, at your expense, and then come back and make you pay the difference. And that's what we call the right to collect deficiency clause. Listen to this one. How about the waiver of state property exemption clause? You know, there are states that have what we call homestead acts or homestead laws. Well, get this. The clause says, each of us hereby, both individually and severally, get that, individually and severally. That means my wife individually or me individually or severally, that's my wife and I together, or me individually and my cosigner, or my cosigner and me severally. Now, we waive any and all benefit or relief from homestead exemption and all other exemptions or moratoriums to which the signers of any of them may be entitled under the laws of this or any state, now in force or hereafter to be passed as against this debt or any renewal thereof. How do you like that? Here's what that says in English. In just ordinary layman's language, it says, if I don't pay, you can come and take even the personal belongings that the state would allow me to keep. Even though the law would allow me to keep this, I agree with you in advance that I'm going to waive that protection so that you can come in here and take my underwear, my shorts, and my T-shirts out of my dresser drawer and go sell it to Goodwill for whatever you can get, and I'll still pay you the difference or the deficiency. Now, did you know you were agreeing to that? No, sir, it's in fine print, number one, and then it's written in very obscure language, number two. And then oftentimes you don't even get a copy of the contract. Those are called adhesion contracts. An adhesion contract. A driver's license is an adhesion contract. You sign an application which refers to the traffic code of your state. The traffic code probably covers two or three great big thick books. I mean, it could be 500 pages to a book with 2,000 traffic laws, and you agree to obey all of those 2,000 traffic laws, laws that you don't know anything about, never heard of, couldn't find at high noon with both hands. But you've agreed to them. And then when the highway patrolman catches you violating one of them, he comes out, stops you, gives you a ticket. And he comes up to you and he says, hey, you slave, you credit debt serf, give me the identification of your master. You reach in your pocket, you pull out the identification of your master, the state of Missouri. And he says, you're in violation of 22404. And you're saying, huh? Yeah, 22404 of the Missouri Revised Statutes. You don't even know what this is. You don't know where to go find it. But it's a contract that you have with the state that you enacted with your driver's license, and you agreed that you wouldn't drive drunk. You agreed that you drive on the right side of the road, stop at the stop signs, drive at certain speeds, and that you would produce your identification upon demand. So when the policeman says, give me your driver's license, and you say, kiss off, sucker, he arrests you and for obstructing and delaying an officer in the performance of his duty, and he'll collect that one too because you agreed to it. Isn't that just special? So these contracts apply to a wide variety of everyday common garden variety circumstances that you're involved in your life all the time. I remember one time I had an OSHA inspector come into my factory. This is when I was in the business world before I had studied any law. I didn't know what the law was, and this guy came in. He was an Oriental guy, a Japanese fellow. And he said that he announced, he gave me his card, and he said, I'm from OSHA, and I'm here to do an inspection. And not being dumb, you know, just being a public school kid, you know, I said, well, what did you come to inspect? And he said, well, I'm here to inspect your working conditions, tools and equipment and worker safety. And I said, who called you here? And he said, nobody. I'm just making my rounds, and I see that this is a factory, a manufacturing plant, so I'm here to inspect. And I said, do you have a search warrant? And he said, well, we don't need a search warrant to come in here and do an inspection. And you know, let me refer you to block number 11. I'm just a public school kid, you know. What do I know? But it seemed like to me that I'd heard somewhere about the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment and a Constitution and crazy stuff like that. I never really studied or knew much about it. You know, we went to public school and they didn't really get very hot and heavy on the, you know, obscure things like constitutional rights and Bill of Rights and things. But, you know, little by little, I'd heard of a few things like that. And I said to this guy, I said, I think you have to have a search warrant. And he looked at me like I was stupid. I think he thought I was Mork from Work. And he raised his voice and he said to me that he didn't need a warrant and that he was here to inspect. And he got up on his high horse, and I mean, this guy was in my office raising his voice to me in my office. And I thought, well, that isn't right. What would you think if I was your guest in your house and I raised my voice to you and said, I want to go into your bedroom and inspect. I want to see what you've got in there. Maybe you've got pornography in your bedroom, Bob. And you might say, George, you've got to have a search warrant. Well, you can't just come into my house and search my bedroom. You know, maybe you've heard something about search warrants along that line too, say. And you might take offense at me, you know, raising my voice in your living room, yelling and screaming at you, telling you that I don't need a warrant to go into your bedroom to search. I mean, you might take offense at that. I did. Well, it wasn't in my bedroom, but it was in my factory. It was my business. I kind of thought it was mine. It wasn't, but then I was just a public school kid. I thought it was my business. I owned it. Well, I really didn't own it, but I thought I owned it. I thought it was mine. So, being the dummy that I am, I grabbed this little fellow. And I shook him a little bit on the way out to the door, and I physically threw his ass right out into the street. And my relationship with the United States of America has never been the same since. The government didn't like me from that point on. I've been very popular in OSHA circles. I don't think I'm very popular with IRS agents. I got a pretty good rapport, though, with the FBI. Last time I talked to them, they were pretty civil to me. Now, I'm really sorry I did that because, see, I was the chief executive officer of a corporation. And that corporation belonged to the state of Idaho, and I was the agent of the state of Idaho, and he was the agent of the United States of America. And he was the superior agent in a guardian ward relationship. He was my superior officer. I was an officer of a corporation owned by the state, and I was the agent of the state. And here came my superior officer. You know, you guys in the Army would look at it like this. Along comes a colonel, and you're a sergeant. And this colonel comes up to you, and he says that he wants to come into your barracks and he wants to look at your footlocker, and you say, you got to have a search warrant, sucker. Now get the hell out of here. And this colonel, you know, not understanding what this sergeant is saying, gets kind of upset. And then you get kind of upset, and maybe you're a little bigger than this colonel, and you grab this colonel, and you shake him till his teeth rattles, and you throw him out of your barracks. Can you see? Your relationship with the United States Army would probably never be the same again. Would it? And that's what happens, you know, when you go to public school and you come out stupid. And that's what happened to me. I went to public school, came out stupid, and I thought I had constitutional rights. boy, did I learn a lesson. Now, I'm trying to share my lessons with you so that you don't make these same mistakes. You see, when I incorporated my business, I gave my business to the state, and they never paid me a dime for it either. But they did give me some benefits. They gave me a thing called limited liability. They said, George, tell you what, you give us your business, and we'll give you limited liability so that if any of your customers are damaged by the products that you're making, they can't sue you. They can only sue the corporation. And that's what Dick Armey did for the pharmaceutical industry. Just before he left office, I think it was in 2000 or 2002, Dick Armey put a rider on a bill, and it said in this rider, said in this clause, in this bill came out of the Congress, it says you cannot sue Merck. If Merck makes a vaccine that kills you, if Merck makes a product over here that kills you, you can't sue Merck. You got to sue the Department of thus and such or so and so. He gave him a free ride. I mean, these contract clauses appear all over the place in both public and private enterprise. See, you could go down here to your local doctor, and your doctor looks at your kid and he says, okay, now let me look at your kid's shot record. And he says, oh my God, your kid hasn't been shot up with snake venom and monkey pus. He's missing this shot over here, and it's the law. You've got to give this kid this shot, and it's going to cost you $25. Now the average guy says, oh, yes, yes, doctor, give my kid that shot, and here's the $25. All right, now that's the average guy. Now the truth of the matter is, that kid really doesn't need that shot. I told you about that last week. Well, under certain circumstances, he doesn't. But here's the bad part. See, once the doctor gives this kid the shot over here, your kid turns up autistic, or he dies, or he gets SIDS, or whatever, and he croaks, or whatever. And now you say, well, my God, it was that shot that did it. And I want to sue the doctor, and I want to sue Merck. Well, thank God for Dick Armey, representative from Texas, who, thinking about the impact that this might have upon corporate America, put this rider on this bill, got the law passed, and the president signed it so that you can't sue Merck. Now, you can go sue some agency of the government and say, hey, listen, put me on the list, and about 20% of people who are damaged that way actually collect some money. The other 80% don't get jack squat. And that's what a contract is. It's an agreement. And the laws that come out of the Congress are contracts with the citizens of the United States. As a citizen of the United States, you have a duty to obey all the laws that come from your master. It's a master-servant relationship. I know, you went to public school and they told you that those lawmakers are public servants. Nope, you got that wrong. They're not public servants. They're guardians. And you have a choice. You can vote for your Republican or Democratic guardian. And once he assumes office, he'll go to Washington and he'll just enact whatever laws he wants, irrespective of what you want. You can write letters to your congressman until you're blue in the face, and he's going to vote the way he wants to vote. More than likely, he's going to vote the way his master tells him to vote. His master being Merck, Ford Motors, or Halliburton, or somebody else, somebody that's just giving him the money to run for re-election, because you're a voter and you can't remember from one election to the next how this guy votes. If that's assuming that you ever knew how he voted to start with. I'll bet you that there isn't 5% of the American public that knows how their congressman or their senator votes on any given bill anyway. And even if they did know how he voted and it really made him mad, they couldn't remember that for 2 years and vote that guy out of office in the next election. And that's demonstrated by the fact that 96% of incumbents are re-elected. Did you know that? 96%. Only 4% of incumbents are turned out of office. I mean, your chances of getting rid of a bad politician like George Bush is near nothing. Hell, your chances of getting convicted are much greater than of being exonerated. Did you know that? Sure. If you're charged with a crime, your chances of being exonerated in a trial are 6%. Your chances of being convicted are 94%. You know, on a standard trial. I mean, you got to do something to fix that, don't you? All right, now when you're dealing with credit, when you're dealing with documents, you're dealing with contracts, boys and girls, you're dealing with the smoking gun. So when you walk into court and MasterCard is suing you because you didn't pay and you think that you're going to come in here and tell the judge, well, look what these guys are doing to me. These are really a bunch of bad guys over here. All the judge is going to do is look at the contract, and your opposing counsel is going to point to Clause 17 on page 5 and say, this guy is in breach of contract, and this is a property issue, and then the credit card company owns that contract, and you're in breach of contract. And it's time for you to bend over, put your head between your knees, and kiss your lower anatomy goodbye. And that's the way that game is played. Now, I know most of you are sitting up there saying, well, if I just get a chance to come in and tell the judge, if I just get a chance to come in and tell the jury my story. Okay, but you're not going to get into court and tell the judge your story, and you're not going to tell the jury your story. And that's because the pleadings in the case are going to limit what you can say when you get in there. And the minute you open your mouth and say something that isn't on the agenda, your opponent's going to object, and the judge is going to say, sustained, and sit down, shut up, fold your hands, or I'll hold you in contempt of court and throw your ass in jail. And then we'll come back and talk about the rest of the penalties. And then you're going to complain and say, there's no justice in America. Well, there's plenty of justice in America. But you're going to be held to the terms and conditions of your contracts, the terms and conditions of your agreements. And if you want to make these agreements, then you're going to be held to them. And let me tell you, boys and girls, on Monday, October the 17th, the world is going to change for you. The world is going to change, just like it did on 9/11. Things are never going to be the same after next Monday, the 17th of October, for you debtors out there. Now, if you're in debt after the 17th, there are some solutions that you can apply, but it's not going to be bankruptcy. You're going to have a better legal solution than bankruptcy, because that's the standard solution. You're going to need some legal training, let me tell you. Well, we're just about out of time. Next time, I'm going to take up the blanket security interest clause. God, that's a fun one. If I don't pay, you can take all the household goods I own. That's called collateral. Do you know that collateralizing a loan is against the law? That God Almighty, the God of creation, prohibits collateralization of a loan? Well, beyond sundown. Did you know he prohibits interest and usury? And yet you're out here signing these contracts, agreeing to pay interest and collateralize the note. So the bottom line is, boys and girls, when you violate the law of God, there's a penalty to pay. And the penalty that you pay is to the lender and to your government. Yeah, your government comes in there, and they're going to collect their pound of flesh along with that creditor who are violating the law of God. But then, hey, you agreed to it. You agreed along with them, the government and MasterCard, that you would be a willing co-conspirator and that you would break the law with them. And next time, I'm going to show you how that little scenario works on Do You Speak Credit, right here on the Law Hour next time. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our webpage. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Remember, it's free. Just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, history, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.